Well, good morning, Redemption. We are back in the Psalms this morning. We are in a series called Quarantined in the Psalms, and hopefully this has been encouragement to you. And this morning, I get to speak on one of my favorite Psalms, maybe my favorite Psalm, Psalm 73. So what we're going to do is we're going to read the first half of this Psalm together and jump right in, because I want to get right to the meat of this particular psalm. It has been so encouraging in my own life, and we'll share some of those ways to you as we unpack it together. So Psalm chapter 73, the psalmist says this: "Truly God is good to Israel, to those whose hearts are pure. But as for me, I almost lost my footing. My feet were slipping and I was almost gone, because I envied the proud when I saw them prosper despite their wickedness. They seem to live such painless lives. Their bodies are so healthy and strong. They don't have troubles like other people. They're not plagued with problems like everyone else. They wear pride like a jeweled necklace and clothe themselves with cruelty. These fat cats have everything their hearts could ever wish for. They scoff and speak only evil. In their pride, they seek to crush others. They boast against the very heavens, and their words strut throughout the earth. And so the people are dismayed and confused, drinking in all their words. What does God know? They ask. Does the Most High even know what's happening? Look at these people, enjoying a life of ease, while their riches multiply." So this particular psalm, I think, speaks to our everyday life. It speaks to things that we deal with on a daily basis. It speaks to our own discontentment in our own life and our problem that we envy other people's life. The 10th commandment functions as a summary commandment. The 10th commandment says, "You shall not covet," and then it lists a bunch of things that belong to other people. And it's the 10th commandment because it serves as a summary that what happens when you break all the other commandments is that you have first coveted, which is why Paul can call covetousness and envy idolatry. The very fact that we covet then brings into our life great discontent. And I don't know about you, but this particular season of life has left me in a state of discontent. It has left me in a place where I look at my life and wonder, why is my life this way? It has to be easier. And it's not just this season of life. It's been throughout my life where I look at other people and other things and wish I could have their life. And at the bottom of it is this unbelief that God is not being good to me, that there are other things besides Him that can actually fill me. And what we need is a supernatural work of the Spirit to give us contentment, to give us hope. Philippians chapter 4, verse 13, Paul says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." And this has been a coffee cup verse for Christians, and in many ways has encouraged Christians throughout their journey. But if you look at the immediate context in Philippians chapter 4, what is it that Paul is saying he can actually find hope and strength for? The thing that Christ is strengthening him is in this very arena that we're talking about of contentment. In the previous verse, Paul says, "I know how to live with a lot, and I know how to live with a little. I have learned in every state that I am to be content because Jesus is strengthening me." And I want to encourage us this morning from Psalm 73 to look to Jesus for our contentment, for our life. And yet discontentment and envy are problems for all of us. It is all around us to see people's lives that are better than us, seemingly, and to want their lives. In fact, Dean Baker, he's a director of the Center for Economic Research and Policy, put out a document a few years ago as he was investigating some of these things. He makes statements in his document, in his research, that says this: "The way that movie stars lived 40 years ago is way different than the way that movie stars and the lifestyles of the rich and the famous live today. Back then, movie stars did not have islands and yachts, and it wasn't well known what their life actually looked like. But today, we have reality TV that tells us what everyone's life looks like, and we have these magazines that are all over the place. They're ubiquitous. They're just everywhere. We see the life that these rich people have. He goes on to say, keeping up with the Joneses is now tougher than ever because of things like Facebook and social media. See, we go on to social media and we are regularly comparing our lives with others. How can that person have this? How can they be pregnant? They don't deserve this. They don't deserve that. We deserve it. See, in the past, people might have been jealous if their neighbor pulled up with a new car. Well, you can see a new car not every year, every 2 years. You see new cars, new things every day from all of your friends on all of your social media platforms. But Christians are not exempt. We are people, just like everyone, who are seeking happiness. We are people who are tempted to look out into the world of Hollywood and social media. And some of you are like me, like, yeah, I don't want to be Brad Pitt. Deep down, I probably do, but I know I can never attain that. But I just look at my life and my friends and see their life is so much better than mine. And see, what the end of the day is what we want is we want their ease. We want their fame. We want their money. We get fed up with our own lives. We get tired of changing diapers every hour of the day when other people are sipping Mai Tais on a resort beach in a fancy place. We get fed up with our same boring job, wondering why we can't just pay for brakes on our car. And then we begin to analyze the Christian faith and we begin to say, is this life really worth it? It definitely seems like the better life is out there. And so we begin to have this crisis of faith. And what I love about Psalm chapter 73 is that this is not an American problem. This is not a problem just for us. This has been a problem throughout the history of humanity. It goes all the way back to Psalm chapter 73 of people looking out and seeing other people's lives. The writer begins to say this, I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. He admits he's in the deep grip of envy and dissatisfaction with his own life. He's envious of the people who have no struggles. You know, the problem comes up, they have money to pay for it. They're healthy and strong. They're not dealing with diseases. They're not dealing with things that happen to us all the time. They're not sick. They're free from the common human burdens. They are not plagued by human ills. How about you? Do you look at other people's lives and just get fed up with your own, being like, I just want a life of ease? And then you begin to examine these people, and you begin to see that they're wicked, and that they don't honor God like you do. They're not serving God like you do. And yet these are the people who are out there seemingly prosper. Envy is in all of us, and it's a desire to want someone else's life. Envy is not just that people don't deserve their good life, but that I do deserve that good life. This spiritual self-pity that we have, this self-loathing that I deserve these things, that God should be rewarding me with this, and envying what other people have, please know this, is sucking all the energy and the joy out of your life. Envy is a soul-sucking robbing of joy. It's impossible to enjoy the things that God has given you when you are in the grip of envy. And this writer, the Psalm of Asaph here, is caught in this grip of envy that he's looking out and seeing the wonderful lives of everyone else, and his life is just filled with misery and trouble. He gets caught in the grip of envy, and it's robbing him of joy. But notice this. The writer also gets caught in the trap of self-righteousness. He gets caught in this trap that he thinks he deserves this life. He's like, God, what are you doing? These people are like despising you out there. They're saying, does God even know what's happening? There's no God. He's not in charge. Meanwhile, I'm here doing my devotions, going to church, honoring you, and the life that they are getting, you're actually giving me the exact opposites. The life of self-righteousness is the life that says, I deserve that life. God, look at me. I've been faithful. I'm the one who should have the easy life. I'm the one who should have no burdens. I'm the one who shouldn't have any sickness. And so when he gets caught in this self-righteousness trap, he begins to question and doubt God. Truly, he says in verse 1, God is good to Israel, but he begins to question, but is he really? And maybe you have that same question. Is God really good to me? If he's really good to me, why is my life suck compared to everyone else's life? He says in the psalm that surely in vain I have kept my heart pure and have washed my hands in innocence. Maybe you feel that way. Maybe you're like, it's been in vain. It's been all empty. It's been futility for me to honor God and to keep going when I don't feel like keep going. All day long, the psalmist says, I've been afflicted. Every morning brings new punishments. Do you feel like every day there's new things piling upon you that God is punishing you? And when you get caught in this self-righteousness trap of thinking God owes you, it causes you to begin to question God himself. And so this self-righteousness begins to look at other people's lives and ask God, are you going to do anything about them? God, what about those people? Are you going to punish them? Are you going to discipline them? Their lives are the ones filled with pride and arrogance. They're the ones who are unforgiving. They're the ones who are mistreating the poor. And you're blessing them. The prosperity of the wicked causes the psalmist to question the benefit of a life lived to honor God. And you can see how in this first half of this psalm, the psalmist is deep in the grip of envy, and he's deep in the grip of self-righteousness, and it is causing him deep grief in his soul, and it's robbing him of joy. So what about you this morning? What are you envious of? What are the things in your life that are robbing you from experiencing joy and being able to find happiness and gladness in the things that God has actually given you? Why don't you hit pause and begin to answer some of these questions together that will be on the screen and take some time to analyze your own heart, your own soul in comparison to the first half of this psalm. Well, I hope the Spirit has been kind to you to unveil and open up some areas maybe where you are envious, and if maybe you don't have those right away, the Spirit would continue to show you those. But I want to read the second half of the psalm and to give us some hope. How do we fight against this envy and this self-pity and this self-righteousness to be able to find hope, to find joy? Let me read the second half of this psalm with you, starting in verse 13. Did I keep my heart pure for nothing? Did I keep myself innocent for no reason? I get nothing but trouble all day long, and every morning brings me pain. If I really spoke in this way to others, I would have been a traitor to your people. So I tried to understand why the wicked prosper, but what a difficult task it is. Then I went into your sanctuary, O God, and I finally understood the destiny of the wicked. Truly, you put them on a slippery path and send them sliding over the cliff into destruction. In an instant, they're destroyed, completely swept away by terrors. When you arise, O Lord, you will laugh at their silly ideas, as a person laughs at dreams in the morning. Then I realized that my heart was bitter, and I was all torn up inside. I was so foolish and ignorant, I must have seemed like a senseless animal to you. Yet I still belong to you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, leading me to a glorious destiny. Whom have I in heaven but you? I desire you more than anything on earth. My health may fail, my spirit may grow weak, but God remains the strength of my heart. He is mine forever. Those who desert him will perish, for you destroy those who abandon you. But as for me, how good it is to be near God. I have made the sovereign Lord my shelter, and I will tell everyone about the wonderful things you do. Wow, what a great hope that there is in the second half of this psalm to fight against this envy, to find joy. And the way that the psalmist does it is he has a reorientation. He has to reorient the way he thinks, and he has to reorient his heart around three different things. He has to reorient, number one, his mind and his heart around the wicked. It says he finally, after trying to process, God, why is all this happening? He had to come into the sanctuary of God and began to understand the end of the wicked. He says, I began to understand their final destiny. The wicked people, these people who seemingly have no troubles, you have put them on a slippery path and a slippery slope. You are going to cast them down to ruin. How suddenly they are destroyed, completely swept away by terrors. See, what he's getting after is that these people's lives who we are envious of are lives that are built on sands, that when the tide comes in, it destroys their entire life. Their life is built on paper. It is very paper thin. The wind blows and their life is knocked over. You may not feel that way, but in eternity, for 1,000 years that you've lived on the new creation, you're going to actually say that their life was built on sands. That you will, in the new creation, experience the life that God wants for you. Their lives are seemingly well fortified with money, power, and ease. Meanwhile, we live in what we think of cardboard boxed homes. And what God is saying is they're like a dream. They're there, but when you awake, their life is gone. You will despise them. You will destroy them. See, we have to come back and actually analyze the life of the wicked. It may seem beneficial, it may seem prosperous, it may seem amazing. And yet what the writer says is when he entered into the sanctuary of God, he began to see that their life is not really life. It can be taken away from them in moments. And even if they have it for many years, eventually the wicked people's lives will be taken away from them because God is actually going to take his presence away from them. See, the sanctuary experience, the coming into the presence of God experienced and stimulated a new awareness of the outcome of the actions of the wicked. They seem invincible, they seem powerful, they seem like nothing can go wrong. But I want you to know something. That their life, even though from the outside looks amazing, when you get to know them, their life is filled with the same miseries that yours are. See, we fail to forget that other people, even though they have money and they seem like they have an easy life, they have broken relationships, internal insecurities, all the things that we deal with, the rich people have as well. And so I just think we have to come in and actually analyze what is their life? What is it built on? And where do we find our life? And what is our life built on? Knowing that as humans, we all have these common problems. But then asking in these common problems, where do I want to build my life? And where do I want to bank my eternal destiny? And so the psalmist has to come and find hope. And number one, the end of the wicked and the end of the righteous. The end of the righteous will not be, according to verse 27, God abandoning us, but it'll actually be God staying with us. Number two, he has to reorient, not just around his understanding of the wicked, but he has to reorient his life around himself. He says this, when my heart was grieved and my spirit was embittered, I was senseless, I was ignorant, I was like a brute beast before you. And what he gets after here is 6 times in the psalm, he uses the word hearts. Heart is a key word in the psalm. And what he's getting after is that the state of his heart determined whether or not he lived in the truth. See, like his affections and what he desired, what he was longing for, was running after things that belonged to things of this world and not a heart that ran after the things of God. And he actually had to come and say that his heart, in a sense, was sick. His heart was grieved. It was in the state of bitterness. And he had to come and do business with his heart. And so I want to encourage you that when we begin to envy and get stuck in this self-pity, this self-loathing, and this self-righteousness, we need Jesus to come and to change our hearts. And how do we get Jesus to come and change our hearts? I think one way we do that is when we look at Psalm chapter 73. We need to see that this is a psalm of Jesus. He was, like us, tempted in every way. He didn't even have a place to lay his head. And yet, in all of that, he did not sin. He continued to put his trust in his Father so that you and I could experience the presence of the love and the life of God. See, when we actually see that this psalm is first the experience of Jesus, and that he passed the test, and he overcame the thoughts of self-pity and the thoughts of self-righteousness, knowing that God was going to reward him, and he did that for us. It gives us a heart that can delight that our life, even though it's built on the rock, doesn't mean it's going to be free from trouble, but it's going to have stability. It's going to have security. It's going to have meaning. It's going to have satisfaction. Even when the winds blow and it looks like our house is getting knocked down and we want to run to the sand and find life there, Jesus is saying, no, I'm keeping you here because this is why I came. The psalmist recognizes that the state of his heart, what his affections are trusting in for joy and satisfaction, are what are ultimates. So church, redemption, I want to ask, what are you doing and what are you placing your affections on? I want to encourage you to look to Jesus as the one who came to rescue you and to take you out of the life of the sand and to put you on the rock. But not only is there a reorientation towards the people outside, and there's a reorientation to our own selves and our own hearts. But finally, there's a reorientation to God. It says in the transition, what changes this entire psalm of one of envy and self-pity and self-righteousness is in verse 15 when he says, when I entered the sanctuary of God. Sorry, verse 17. I went into your sanctuary. The sanctuary in the Old Testament is the place where God's presence was. It's the place where God dwelled. It's been common for churches to call the meeting place where they have their Sunday morning gatherings the sanctuary. But really, the sanctuary is the presence of God. It's not a room. It's not a building. It's actually the very presence of God himself. And when he got into the presence of God, everything became clear. See, we remove ourselves from the presence of God and we remove ourselves from the benefits of the presence of God. And that is where all of our trouble begins. And all of our answers come in coming back into the sanctuary, coming back into the presence of God. When you are in the presence of God, his presence fills you with his love and his life. And there's no deeper joy than to be filled with the love of God and the life of God. The Spirit of God has been given to us as the presence of God, as a foretaste. As Christians, we get a preliminary taste, like getting a sample in front of, you can't do it anymore, in front of the mall and getting a little piece of Chick-fil-A chicken that wants you to get more. And this is the idea of like the Spirit. It's like this little sample that the Spirit fills us with the love and the life of God that in the new creation we're going to experience eternally and endlessly. And so when he enters the sanctuary, he can say things like this. But as for me, it is good to be near God. The goodness, the nearness of God is my good. I have made God, I've made Jesus my shelter, my refuge. So I'm an envious person. mainly because I want to win lots of things. And when other people are seemingly succeeding more than me, I get envious of them. I want to win. I want to have what they have. I want to have a life that is filled with ease. There is my comfort coming out. And regularly throughout my life in the last couple years, I've been saying things like, God, I envy those who envy those kids who have a mom who can take care of them and nurture them. I am envious that I don't have someone else to help me. I am envious that I don't have a second income to help me pay my bills. I am envious that other people have money to pay for their car breaks. I am envious of all of these people's lives and the things that they have accumulated in the seeming ease of their life. And it makes me question, is being a pastor worth it? It makes me question, is Christianity worth it? And yet God, in Psalm 73 over the last several years, continues to say to me, Scott, more money is not your good. My nearness is your good. I hear God continually coming to me and saying, what the goodness that your kids need is not a mom, but it's me. What I hear God telling me over and over and over again is he's saying, Scott, my presence is your good. And I want to encourage you that in the midst of your envy, in the midst of your discontented life, that often wells up into this self-righteousness where you feel like God owes you because you deserve the good life, to be reminded that the reason that the new creation that we hold out hope for, that our lives are built on the rock, knowing that we will never be taken away from that life is so good because in that new world, God in his fullness comes to be with us, and God's presence is our good. So church, press into God's presence. Press into the Spirit. Press into this fact that God is with you. And I know if you're like me, you don't always feel it. There's not always this existential, experiential time where we just like so happy. But to come back and just analyze the end of the wicked, analyze where our hearts are, and then begin to reorient our life around the goodness of God and his presence is where our joy is. And in this time, you might be saying, you know what's good? It's for me to get back to regular life. And what this psalm is telling us is, no, what is good for you is to be near God. So Jesus, help us see that you came to bring us this presence, and you've sent your Spirit to us to fill us with your presence. And may we as a church find this presence as our all-consuming good, that we can say we have nothing on heaven and earth that we desire more than to be with you.